So I have a small scientific experiment I want to conduct today. In the 18th century, the English Unitarian minister, Reverend Joseph Priestley, conducted an experiment. And he did this with a live rat. I do not have a live rat today, but I did find a mouse in my office that we will use instead. Reverend Priestley had a laboratory. Actually, it was the kitchen in the manse where he was the minister. And there was a water board there that he used for this. Okay, this is not working. I don't have water here. It would be too messy to do this. But what he did was he had the water, and then he had a little candle like this. If I hold it up, you'll probably... How are we doing? There we go. You can see this. Okay. There's the candle. And he did something which he had done many times as a child, as an experiment. He lit the candle, and then he covered the candle with a glass container. And the reason he had it in a water space is that he could reach underneath, lift the glass container up, and put something in it without breaking the seal. And he waited for a few seconds to see what would happen. And of course, he had done this as a child with spiders inside. And if you just wait a few seconds, the candle will go out. And no one at Joseph Priestley's time, and the time that he did this originally was 1771, knew why the candle would go out. They just know that it did. And then he had put a mouse inside, a smaller mouse probably than this one, and after a few minutes after the candle went out, the mouse died, or the rat, or the spider, whatever life form he put in there. And no one knew why this happened, only that it did. Well, Priestley was a Unitarian minister, and he was curious about things, and he kept trying different experiments, and he put a candle in, let it go out, and then he lifted it up far enough so that he didn't break the seal, so that the atmosphere inside the bowl did not change, but he put a plant inside. It was a smaller plant than I have. So he lit the candle again, hoping that the plant would not catch fire. And he put all of this underneath here. Like this. Let's just pull this out here of the container. Yeah. Part of the plant burned, but most of it survived. And he left it there for several weeks, and the plant didn't die. The plant kept growing. It had adequate water through the water board. It continued to survive, even though the mouse he put in there, the rat he put in there, the spider he put in there, they all died. But then he tried something really interesting. He reached underneath the water without breaking the seal, with another rat that he had captured, and he put the rat in with the plant in this atmosphere where the candle had gone out. And the rat didn't die. The plant had been there for a couple weeks or so, and the rat was fine. It didn't die. He wrote a paper about this. He made up a name for what he had discovered. Other people didn't like that name and said, let's call it oxygen. So this Unitarian minister in Birmingham, England, in 1771, on his spare time when he wasn't preparing sermons, in the kitchen of his house, what we like to call now his laboratory, discovered oxygen. And also, of course, discovered in this process the whole cycle of carbon dioxide, that in order for us to live on this planet, we breathe in oxygen as mammals, and that oxygen is used by our bodies and fuses our bodies with energy, but then it has to be recreated. And so we have all these plants that produce oxygen for us using the carbon dioxide that we breathe out in order to survive. Well, he published these papers and he became famous among scientists. One of his good friends was Benjamin Franklin, and the progressive scientists in France were very impressed with all of this work. But what happened is that after the French Revolution, which occurred with the storming of the Bastille, as stated at that date, July 14th, 1789, people became more and more distrustful in Birmingham, England, of Joseph Priestley. They thought, this guy who does these experiments on all these things, he's just like these folks in France. And look at the chaos that they have there. They've put the king in prison. They're talking about trying him and executing him. Things are out of control. And he's going to cause the same kind of unrest in our country. So after they had been at the pub for a while, on the second anniversary of the storming of the Bastille in Birmingham, England, on July 14th, 1791, a group of them who were being very, very upset about this decided that they needed to take action. They feared Joseph Priestley, this Unitarian minister. And they went to the Unitarian chapel in Birmingham, England, and they burned it down. July 14, 1791. Some members of the congregation, a couple young men, ran to Priestley's home. He lived a couple miles out of town because the mob, after they burned down the chapel, started to march towards the manse where the minister lived. And they said to Joseph Priestley and Mary Priestley that the mob was coming and that they needed to get out. Well, Joseph and Mary thought that it was unlikely they would be attacked by a mob. They'd just lived in Birmingham for 11 years without any serious difficulty. But the young men from the church insisted that they were in danger. So the couple hid a few valuables in the manse, and then, taking nothing with them but their clothing, they went to the home of a friend who lived about a mile away from where they lived. By midnight, the mob had demolished the home. They burned Reverend Priestley's laboratory. They burned his library. They burned his manuscripts on which he had recorded not only his religious views of Unitarianism, but also the results of his scientific experiments. Priestley could look across the field a mile away and see his house on fire. We can only imagine his thoughts in the distance as he could hear the shouts of the mob destroying his home, destroying his laboratory where he conducted these experiments. He could hear them destroying his manuscripts, the records of his experiments, the records of his life work. He went back to his friend's house about 4 a.m., and he and Mary prepared to go to bed. But word came that the mob was advancing towards that house also. They heard where Joseph Priestley was. So they got up and they fled 5 miles further to the home of another neighbor, where their daughter and son-in-law were living. And they arrived just before breakfast. For about 12 hours, they appeared to be safe. But by evening, on the 15th of July, the mob had gotten word where Joseph Priestley was hiding, and they marched towards the home of his daughter. So Joseph Priestley and his wife Mary discussed what to do, and they decided that Mary should remain with their daughter, who was about to give birth to a child. Mary stayed with her daughter, who was pregnant. The family hoped that the mob only wanted Reverend Priestley, only the minister, and would not harm his wife or his pregnant daughter. So Reverend Priestley and a servant mounted horses and started for London from Birmingham. And in London, they took refuge in the home of Reverend Lindsay, the minister of the Unitarian Chapel in London. The mob was afraid of Priestley. They wanted to kill him because they believed, with all his new ideas about religion and science, he was a threat to their way of life. Well, it turned out that Priestley was right about the gases oxygen and carbon dioxide. In the 19th century, a British physicist, John Tyndall, discovered that certain gases in the atmosphere, including carbon dioxide, were trapping heat on the Earth. And in moderation, this is a good thing. Without the natural greenhouse effect, the Earth would freeze. Any basic Earth science textbook today talks about the natural greenhouse effect. It is a phenomenon that is not in any way debated. Global warming says if you increase the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you will also increase the Earth's average temperature. It's an indisputable fact of science that we have increased greenhouse gas concentrations in the air, and as a result of human activity, it's an indisputable fact that over the last few decades, average global temperatures have gone up. In the scientific community, there's a very broad consensus that global warming is underway. As best as can be determined, the Earth's atmosphere is now warmer than it has been at any point in the last 2,000 years. And if current trends continue, by the end of the century, it will be hotter on Earth than at any point in the last 2 million years, by the end of this century. Because climate determines what crops we can grow, what pests and diseases we have to worry about, and how we get fresh water, many sober-minded, coolly analytical scientists like Joseph Priestley agree that the lives of all living things, including humans, are about to change in big, dramatic ways. Still, just as in Joseph Priestley's time, there is today a large gap between the scientific community and the lay community's opinions on climate change. The mob that burned Priestley's Unitarian Chapel and his home and his books and records did so because they were afraid that Dr. Priestley's and others like him were going to change the way they lived. They threatened the survival of their way of life. In the same way, the owners of oil and coal companies have conducted well-financed campaigns designed to convince people that climate change is not occurring. They are afraid that the scientists are trying to change their way of life. Those who deny climate change believe that they are fighting a battle of survival for their children, for their grandchildren. I mean, things have been pretty good, and now these scientists want to change it all. We've got to stop them. As a result, although the 1997 Kyoto Protocol envisioned that the United States would first reduce its carbon dioxide emissions to 1990 levels and then further reduce them by 7%, the treaty was never ratified by the United States Senate. Although in the year 2000, a majority of Americans voted for the environmentalist Al Gore for president, by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court appointed George W. Bush as president. And for 8 years, no significant effort was made in the United States to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. Although the 2006 movie, An Inconvenient Truth, raised awareness of the problem, it did not result in changes in our nation's policies. Barack Obama took office in January of 2009, and environmentalists hoped that with his leadership, the issue would finally be addressed. As we know, after the midterm elections of 2010, our divided national legislature has ceased to function. Still, President Obama has used his authority to expand the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to monitor and regulate greenhouse gas emissions. In September of 2013, the Environmental Protection Agency proposed an effective carbon pollution standard for new power plants and will propose a standard for existing power plants in June of 2014. In the absence of any functioning national legislature, more and more efforts to curb greenhouse gases are occurring in our state governments. According to yesterday's Washington Post, in state capitals across the country, legislatures are requiring utilities to use solar and wind energy and reduce carbon emissions from power plants. Of course, the oil, coal, and natural gas interests are fighting this. For example, in the state of Kansas, the Kansas economy relies heavily on fossil fuels. The state is the nation's 10th largest producer of crude oil and the 12th largest producer of natural gas. In 2013, coal-fired power plants provided 61% of the state of Kansas electricity. But in Kansas, in the legislature, a law passed in 2009 that requires utilities to use wind and solar power to generate at least 15% of their electricity by 2016 and 20% by 2020. Well, this spring, when the legislature was in session, the Kansas Chamber of Commerce, Koch Industries, Edison Electrical Institute, and the nation's biggest coal company, Peabody Energy, and Kansas for Liberty and Americans for Prosperity, they all formed a coalition to lobby the state legislature for repeal of this proposal to require 15% of electricity in 2016 to be produced by wind and solar power. They wanted to stop this. But here's the good news. In Kansas, the owners of wind farms are gaining political power. They make money generating electricity on wind farms, and they have lobbyists. Suddenly, 19% of the state's electricity comes from wind farms. It just blows all the time in Kansas. Wind also creates manufacturing jobs. So a manufacturing plant in Kansas makes the automobile-sized units that contain wind turbine gearboxes and electrical control equipment. And they have a big contract with Iowa to put wind farms up there. As a result, these two bills, which tried to postpone the renewable targets, and another one which just said, let's repeal these renewable targets, they both failed in the Kansas State House, in spite of the coal and the oil and the natural gas interests. So in Kansas, the climate change deniers are losing. And there's more good news. The price of solar panels has fallen more than 75% just since 2008. As of the first quarter of 2014, in 79 countries across the globe, the price of electricity produced by photovoltaic solar cells is equal to or less than the average price on the electrical grid. So we are seeing a quiet shift towards renewable energy. When it comes to electricity produced by solar cells, the climate change deniers are losing. A few years ago, Malcolm Gladwell wrote a popular book called The Tipping Point. The tipping point is defined as that magical moment when an idea, a trend, a social behavior crosses a threshold and suddenly spreads like wildfire. In our lifetimes, we have seen many such tipping points. Moments when what seemed impossible became possible. I think of curb cuts. Now, most of you are at least my age or older. Imagine back 50 years ago at the streets and the sidewalks of our country. There were no sidewalk curb cuts at intersections for wheelchairs. Obviously, we weren't going to do this because it was expensive, and it would only affect a very small number of people who are in wheelchairs, not a strong political lobbying group. Today, everywhere I go in the United States, I see curb cuts. When I despair that our society can never change, I look at sidewalk intersections. Now, there are many other examples of tipping points. 50 years ago, it would have been impossible to ban smoking in public places like restaurants. I remember taking a flight across the United States in 1981 and becoming physically ill by all the people who were smoking in my part of the airplane. We would never do that on an airplane or in a restaurant in our country today or in many other parts of the world. 50 years ago, if you were a homosexual, you would be sent to prison. Not happening anymore. 50 years ago, it would have been impossible to elect a person of color as president of the United States. You can think of your own examples. We reach a moment in our society, in our culture, where many people's feelings shift. A majority of Americans are now no longer afraid of not being able to smoke in a restaurant, That's not a violation of your liberty and your freedom as an individual not to be able to have a cigarette in a restaurant. It's just part of who we are. A majority are no longer afraid of having a person of color as president. A majority are no longer afraid of gay marriage. Perhaps we are reaching a political tipping point around the issue of climate change. Well, Joseph Priestley went to London and Reverend Lindsay took him in. And then in 1794, with the help of friends such as Benjamin Franklin, he moved his family to the United States. And 2 years later, in 1796, he worked with 20 of Philadelphia's intellectual leaders and formed the first Unitarian Society of Philadelphia. It was the first continuously functioning church in the United States to name itself Unitarian. Over two centuries, Unitarians and Universalists have continued to pursue Reverend Priestley's interest in science and in religion. Now, 30 years ago, in 1984, at the annual meeting called the General Assembly, the Unitarian Universalist Association voted to revise its statement of purpose. By the way, the next meeting will be in Providence, Rhode Island, at the end of June. If you're interested in attending as a delegate, please see me or a member of our board. But at this General Assembly in 1984, 30 years ago, after a four-year discussion, after countless meetings and hearings, I'll bet Pauly went to a whole bunch of these, lots of us did, after many efforts to get the wording just right, a draft was presented to be voted on, revising our statement of purposes and our statement of principles. After 4 years of work, the committee hoped that their statement, having been carefully wordsmithed, would be approved by the delegates without any amendments. You can see it in the hymnal, if you have one, at the beginning of the hymnal. You know, after so much discussion, after so much debate and refining and reforming, it seemed likely that finally the statement of purposes and principles would be adopted overwhelmingly by the assembly and without any amendments. So it came to the floor, and out of the crowd of delegates, my friend and colleague Paul LaRue went to the microphone and said, "I want to propose an amendment." And everyone groaned. Paul moved that the wording of the last principle, the seventh principle, be changed. It said, "We affirm respect for the earth and the interdependence of its living systems." And Paul said, "I move that we amend it to say, we affirm respect for the interdependent web of all existence, of which we are a part." Well, the assembly was tired of discussion. It was put to a vote, and it was unanimously approved. It's interesting to note, in retrospect, that of all the seven principles that we have affirmed as central to our religious community, it is the seventh principle, affirmed and offered at the last moment and accepted without debate, that is today best known. 30 years later, the sweeping reach of that affirmation has become more and more clear to those of us who have thought about its implications. It describes the work of Joseph Priestley, a minister and scientist trying to understand the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And it describes the work of Unitarian Universalists today. My colleague, Reverend David Bumbaugh, put it better than I can. David is a wonderful writer and poet. So I end with David's words about the seventh principle. Hidden in this apparently uncomplicated, uncontroversial statement is a radical theological position. The seventh principle calls us to reverence before the world, not some future world, but this miraculous world of our everyday experience. It challenges us to understand the world as relational rather than hierarchical. It beseeks a world in which neither God nor humanity is at the center, in which the center is a void, the ever-fruitful matrix out of which being emerges. It bespeaks a world in which, because all things impinge on all other things, everything matters. It challenges us to accept personal responsibility for the whole and for all parts of the whole. Since it in an interactive network, every decision, every relationship has significance for every other decision and every other relationship. It calls us to trust the process, the creative, evolving, renewing, redeeming process which brings us into being, which sustains us in being, and which transforms our being. It offers a vision of a world in which the holy, the sacred is incarnated in every moment, in every aspect of being.